No? Everyone's happy? Okay, so then maybe some administrative stuff, which actually maybe, well, okay. So I'll do it anyway, even though probably some people are still coming in later. But the it's maybe time to start thinking about your final projects for those who are taking the class for credit. You don't have to do anything yet. I'm just suggesting that it's time to start thinking about them. Maybe it's good if you could try to pick a topic by, say, beginning of March, which would probably leave you enough time to actually write the thing. So the other thing in relation to the projects is that I intend to have people give presentations on the what they've learned for the rest of the class. So on the original syllabus I handed out, I said there was a question mark next to that, and I had April 3rd as the date, but I'm considering moving it to April 10th, which would give everybody another week to work on it. But I'm a little worried that it would conflict with exams. So is this likely to be a problem for people? Any ideas, suggestions? Okay, well, no one's complaining. But I'll bring it up again, maybe at the end of the class when there's usually more people here. Okay, so in that case, let's get started on the actual scientific content. So at the end of last time, we were talking about codes and priority metrics. So we defined a poly group. Over two debts. And while I defined a poly group for general dimensions, I specialized by the end of the lecture to the case of prime dimensions. And so the definition of the poly group, remember, was the set of things of the form omega to the A, x to the B, z to the C, with omega being p3 of unity, x is adding 1 mod p, and z is a phase. Right? So this polygroup has properties similar to the qubit polygroup, the most obvious difference being that things no longer commute or anti-commute. They commute up to a phase of some power of omega. In particular, what was it, x, z, is an omega inverse. X, z is omega inverse, z, x. Right? And using this fact, you can define something like stabilizer codes. In fact, they are stabilizer codes for this higher dimensional poly group. So I'm not going to repeat the definition. You can get it from the lecture notes last time or go to the end of the recording. But it basically works the same way as for qubits, right? We have a abelian group, which is a stabilizer, and the code is a plus one eigenstate of everything in the stabilizer. And then you can, again, define n of s, set of things that commute with stabilizer, and n of s minus s is the detectable errors for that code. So what I'd like to do now is give you some examples of stabilizer codes in higher dimensions. So first example . So if you recall from the problem set, you showed that there was no 3, 1, 2 stabilizer code for qubits. And actually, in the lecture last time, I showed using linear programming blocks, there was no code with those parameters, even non-stabilizer codes, right? Using the Williams identity and the shadow enumerator. But when you go to higher dimensions, you get more freedom. And so it turns out there is a 312 code in higher dimensions. So in particular, here's a very kind of easy one for cube tricks. Okay? Well, so what is the distance two codes look like, right? Well, it should have one generator, which will anti-commute with x's, and one generator that will anti-commute with z's. Well, for qubits, sorry, it's anti-commute. For these, it's omega commuting, right? So one generator that's used to detect x's and one that detects z's. So for instance, we could pick this. Right? And so this one will detect any z errors. This one will detect any x errors. And if we have x to some power, z to some power, well, it'll be detected by both of these with some eigenvalue. It's maybe worth saying that in this case, if you look at, so first of all, there's a couple of things to say. So first of all, for qubits, this didn't work, right? Because these two things anti-commuted. So they couldn't form a stabilizer. But in dimension three, well, you get one factor of omega every time for each of these, right? So if you move this whole thing past this whole thing, you get omega cubed, which is one. Right? So this is a valid stabilizer, therefore gives us a stabilizer code, 312 code. And remember, this subscript 3 is used to indicate the dimension that we're working in this case, Q-tricks. So the other thing that's worth noticing is that these things have eigenvalues which are powers of omega, not plus or minus 1. So for instance, if you have a z error, that will give you an eigenvalue of, I don't know, either. I guess it'll give you an eigenvalue of omega inverse for xxx here. Okay? So. So an eigenvalue of omega inverse means that. It's a plus one eigenstate of this. So minor notational issue. Whereas if you have a z squared error, you get a plus one eigenvalue of omega squared xxx. So the point is that you have additional information in this error syndrome, right? The error syndrome is not a bit anymore. It's a, well, in this case, a trick. Right, 0, 1, or 2. It's the power of omega that you're using. And if you're in p dimensions in general, it's a mod p thing. Okay? So you have more information from the same stabilizers, which is one reason why you can correct more errors, right? Since this 312 code wasn't possible. The other reason, of course, is that you have this extra freedom of commutativity. You have more powers that you can stick in here. And so in fact, it turns out that there's a 312 code for any dimension. Three or larger, or well, yeah, any stabilizer code. So I'm only interested right now in the prime ones. And one of the problems on the homework assignment is to find such codes, actually more general family, for any N12 greater than equal 3. Okay? So that's a very simple code. We can also look at more complicated codes. We We can look at more complicated codes. For instance, we can generalize the 5-qubit code we had before to a 5-qudit code. How are we going to do that? Well, there's various ways you can do that, but it's going to have basically the same structure as before. Now, for some reason, I recall there being some reason why there's these inverses up here. But when I looked at this, I can't see any possible reason for that. It still commutes when you have powers of 1 up there instead of powers of minus 1. But it's nice to put it in this form just because it reminds you that there's different things you can do in this case of higher dimensions. But you can see, so for instance, you can see that these things commute with each other. Well, how is that? Well, it takes a little more work in this case to see that. Because here you have zx, right? So if you try to move those past each other, you get a power of omega. Well, here you have xi that commutes, z inverse and z will commute. But x inverse, z inverse, well, now it's going the other way. So you get an omega inverse to the power minus 1 times minus 1. So those two cancel out. And so here you get an omega inverse. So those two cancel out and you get 1. And it's the same thing for any two of these. Okay, so that's why this is an abelian group, and therefore it defines a stabilizer. I should say that this extra condition that we had in the qubit case about minus 1 not being in the stabilizer, we don't need it in this qudit case. That's one of the advantages. So remember, I pointed out last time that this annoying factor of I that appears in the definition of y is equal to ixz, that was for qubits. And it didn't appear in the qudit case. So we don't have to put that extra constraint on the stabilizer here. Just as in the abelian group. Okay? And you can, so basically by the same argument as before, you can see that it's going to be distance 3, although it requires maybe more things to check because it's could be up to power p x. You have to look at errors x to the a, z to the b, where a and b can both be up to p minus 1. Okay. So now let's look at an even bigger family of codes. Well, I guess this is only one code. Well, two codes now. But now let's look at a bigger family of codes with multiple codes in them that can actually do things that are well beyond what you can do with qubits. So what are those? So these are the polynomial codes. And so these polynomial codes are actually higher dimensional generalizations of CSS codes. They're based on classical codes, specifically the classical Reed-Solomon codes. Reed-Solomon codes are pretty useful codes classically as well, which is why it makes sense that when you use them to make a quantum code, you also get useful codes. And the classical Reed-Solomon codes also higher dimensional things. So there's a lot of work classically on these higher dimensional codes because, well, for various reasons. One reason is that they're useful when you put them together to make even better codes, even bit codes. I probably won't talk about that in the class, but we will talk about concatenation in a little bit, and then you'll see how one way of putting two codes together to get another code. So these things are useful when you start to concatenate. Okay. Anyway, so the definition of the code. Let's define what happens to the basis states. So we're going to have a bunch of coefficients, a1, a0 up through ak minus 1, so we'll have k encoded bits, q bits. And that's going to get mapped to a superposition of classical code words, just in the same way as it was for binary CSS code. And these are going to be of this form. So alpha 0 for alpha n minus 1 are non-zero numbers mod p. And the f's, so the sum is over all polynomials with a maximum degree g. And so if we write f as, you know, in the normal expansion of polynomials, it's going to be of this form, cj x to the j. And what we're going to do is we're going to let these encoded, the basis state, the index of the encoded state, be some of the coefficients of the polynomial. So we're going to have cj is equal to aj for j, well, for j up to k minus 1. And then for the remaining, so g has to be greater than k. And for the remaining coefficients, we sum over them, over all possibilities. Okay? And so that's what this tells us. So what we're going to do is we're going to take all polynomials whose low order coefficients are fixed, and then sum over the higher order terms, over all possible higher order terms, and evaluate those polynomials at n different points. Okay, and that's our tech. That's our state. Okay, does everyone understand this encoding?
Can you repeat the summing over CJs?
Yeah, so the point is that the sum here is over different possible Fs. And specifically, we're going to sum over Fs that have fixed values of CJ for low J. And we're going to vary over possible cj for higher k, for j greater than or equal to k. Yeah?
The alpha are arbitrary?
The alpha are arbitrary, but can't be 0. They have to be. They also have to be different. Because otherwise, it would be kind of silly. You just get two registers that have the same thing. OK? Well, there's n points, so it's 0 to n minus 1. So this is supposed to be n qubit, n physical qubits here.
That's first, j minus 1 are orthomorphic.
No. Of these, no. So the point is that the coefficients here are fixed. They're these things. But so this is why it's important that it not be 0. So if you evaluate this point at 0, you'll just get the 0 coefficient here. But if you evaluate it anywhere else, you'll get some linear combination of these coefficients, right? So none of these points actually represents exactly any of those numbers. I mean, it might be just by coincidence, but not reliable. OK?
Can we see an example?
Yeah, well, OK. So so let's take a very simple example. So I've had you work out a more complicated example in the problem set. But a very simple example, let's take k equals 1 and g equals, well, 2 is the most trivial one. And so let's take n equals three and we'll let p equal 5. Not exactly sure what we'll get here, but we'll try it. So I guess the other condition I have to make, obviously since these are different points and they're not zero, p has to be greater than n. Greater, yeah, because there's n points plus zero, there's n plus one points, so p has to be at least that large. Okay, so that's why I had to pick p equals 5. I couldn't pick p equals 3 in this case. So okay, so let's see what happens. Well, so we have four possible things, but let's just pick this constant term a. And well, what are the possible polynomials, right? So g equals 2. So we have a constant term, which is going to be a, plus some c1x plus c2x squared. Okay? And we're going to sum over c1 and c2. So what do we get? Well, so we get, and we have to evaluate this. Oh, and we have to pick points also. What are the points? The points are going to be alpha 0 is, might as well pick it to be 1, alpha 1 is 2, and alpha 2 is 3. Okay, so we have three different points, and we're going to evaluate this polynomial at each of these points. Well, so first, let's go c1, c2, both 0. Right, so that's a perfectly valid term. And what do we get when we have that? Well, we have right. So in this term, we're going to always have a. Right. But that's of course just one term in superposition. Now we have to go to the case where c1 is 1, and c2 is 0. So c1 is 1. So we have now a. So we have a plus x, so it's a plus 1, a plus 2, a plus 3. Right? And you can see that, well, just taking different values of c1, we're getting here in the middle a plus c1, a plus 2 c1, a plus 3 c1. Okay, so we have four more terms, well, four terms like that, 1, 2, 3. For C1 equal 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? And then we have to add the case where we have C2 is equal to 1. And then, let's do it over here. C2 is equal to 1, and then C1, again, 0, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. So when C2 is equal to 1 and C1 is equal to 0, we get A plus 1 squared, A plus 2 squared, a plus 3 squared. Well, so 9, we have to take that mod 5, so we get 4. Okay, and then we get the corresponding term here, so which is a plus x squared. So what's that? Well, it's these, and then we just add 1, 2, 3, right? So it's a plus 2. 4 plus 2 is 6, which mod 5 is 1. And 4 plus 3, 7, mod 5 is 2. So it's a plus 2. Okay? And again, you get things like this. And then we have to keep on doing this. And the general term here, of course, is a plus, plus c1 plus c2, right, for evaluated at 1. Here you have a plus c1 times 2, plus c2 times 2 squared, so it's 4. And here a plus 3 c1, again plus 4 c2. Okay? I don't know if that was what you were looking for. So as usual, you don't really want to write it out in this exhaustive fashion, because there's a lot of terms in this stuff. But you can do it in terms of, I mean, just thinking of it like this, it tends to be very helpful already. Or you can go to a stabilizer form, which is also something. Yeah?
What's the distance of that example?
Well, so actually what I'm going to calculate now is the distance of the arbitrary kiss. So we'll do that, and then if you want, we can go back. So this is one of those cases where it's easier to do the arbitrary case than the specific case, because the specific case has a lot of ugly detail. The general case, well, it's polynomials. It has a lot of nice mathematical structure that makes it easy, or at least not too hard. I guess there's a distinction between those two. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, remember, this is a CSS code of some sort, right? So what's the first code? Well, so C1, so C1 is a classical code, which is basically of this form, right? It's f evaluated at these n points, where f can be just anything of degree up to g. And C2, the subcode, is, well, it's the same thing. Sorry, this is C2 perf. But now, same constraint on degree. But now the lower order terms, the lower order coefficients of f are constrained. And well, in the general quantum code, they could be anything, right? And then we just did the appropriate superposition. But those are all cosets of the original C1 mod C2 perf. And so what we want is C2 perf to be the case where these coefficients are all zero. Okay. So that basically, that's what you get if you have the encoded zero, all zeros stay up there. You get a superposition over elements of C2 perf, right? And if you have any other thing, you'll get a coset of the superposition over C2 perf. And the whole thing, the union of all of those cosets will make up C1. Okay? So anyway, so to find out the distance, we just have to find out the distance of C1 and the distance of C2. Turns out these codes are not degenerate. They're non-degenerate, so actually the distance will be the minimum of these two distances. So what is the distance of C1? Well, so we can figure this out by looking at erasure errors. So suppose we have a code word of this form. We know the polynomials have degree less than or equal to g. So how many points do we need before we can reconstruct this polynomial? G plus 1, right? So this is just a general fact about polynomials, but really it's just a fact about linear equations. Because if you plug in, well, so you have a general expansion of the polynomial, right? And you plug in points at it, well, you get linear equations on the coefficients, right? And the polynomial of degree g has g plus 1 coefficients. In the case where they're unconstrained. So we need g plus 1 points to reconstruct the polynomial, which means that if we have, so there's n points altogether, so if we have n minus g plus 1 erasures, then we can correct it. Right? And that tells us distance of the code 1 is this plus 1. So it's n minus g. Okay? Okay. So at this point, I think it's helpful to try to figure out the distance of C1 perf, which is a little bit silly because we don't actually care about C1 perf, we care about C2. But we know that C1 prep is included in C2, and so it's going to be a nice warm-up. Okay, so what is the distance of C1 perp? Well, the distance of C1 perp is going to be the smallest linear equation that we can write down between the points of C1. Right? So if C1 perp is the dual to C1, right? So it's the distance of it is the smallest weight, and it's a linear code, so the distance is the smallest weight code word in it. Smallest weight of a code word in it, right? Which is the smallest linear equation that we can write down that relates points of this code. Okay, follow that logic? So anyway, so what is that? So, well, we know that these polynomials, again, we can use this idea of polynomial interpolation. Not only do we need given g plus 1 points, we can reconstruct a state. But given any fewer than g points, well, the polynomial, there is a polynomial that's consistent with that. Right? Or, sorry, given even g plus 1 points, there's a polynomial that's consistent with that. Okay? So what that means is that the distance, so g plus 1 points are arbitrary. But once we have g plus 1 points, the g plus second point is constrained. And so what that means is that there are linear equations that relate g plus 2 points. In fact, it's true for any g plus 2 points. It doesn't have to be true for general error correcting code, but in case of these codes, it is. So the distance here is equal to g plus 2. Okay? So this is the number of linear equations we need, number of points we need to have a linear equation that relates them. Okay, so so this is only true if you have polynomials, arbitrary unconstrained polynomials of degree g. So what happens when we go to d of c2? Which is basically the same thing, except that we're constraining the polynomials. Well, we get more possible linear relations that relate things, right? Because we already know something about the polynomials. And so whereas before there were kind of g plus 1 degrees of freedom, now we have g plus 1 minus k. And so what that means is that the distance of C2 is going to be g plus 2 minus k. Okay. You can work that out in more detail if you like. Anyway, the upshot of this is that the distance of quantum code is the minimum of these two distances, which of course, it's the minimum of n minus g and g plus 2 minus k. Okay, so that doesn't tell us much since we haven't picked g yet. But the sensible thing to do is to pick g so that these two are equal, or as close to equal as we can make them. So we choose a g so that n minus g is equal to g plus 2 minus k. So that's telling us that 2g plus 2 is equal to n plus k. So g plus 1 is n plus k over 2, using that wonderful eraser property we call it. OK? So plugging this number in, so of course if this is even, we can do that. If n plus k is even, we can do that. If n plus k is odd, then we'll have to round either up or down. It's not really going to make a difference. It means that one of these is one greater than the other. So anyway, so let's take the case where they're even, just for simplicity. And so then we get, plugging this in, we get, well, n minus g is, actually maybe this one's easier. So g plus 2 minus k is, so it's this plus 1 minus k. So plus k over 2 minus k is going to be n minus k over 2 plus 1. Okay? So let's see. So plugging this formula in, since I didn't pick, well, okay, first of all, did I pick g correctly? Well, n plus k in that case was 4 divided by 2. And so g plus 1 was actually supposed to be 2. So I was supposed to pick g equals 1. So I didn't pick the right g up there for the optimal distance. But what happens for the actual distance I did pick? Well, n minus g is 1. And g plus 2 minus k is 3. So I kind of picked a stupid code where one of the distances was maximal, and the other distance was trivial, so it couldn't correct any errors. So it corrects basically all, in this case, phase errors and no bit flip errors. All meaning 1 in this case. The maximum you could do was 3. Yeah?
What would happen if you choose like n odd and k even?
If you choose n odd and k even. Well, so what will happen then is you won't be able to obviously pick g that's equal to this. But if you pick it close to it, so if you pick it just, so it'll be n, it'll be, you know, it'll be a half integer. So if you pick the integer just below it or just above it, then what will happen is these two will be different by one. One of them will be slightly bigger than the other. And so you'll be able to correct kind of a half extra phase error. Or say, if you're talking about erasures, you can correct one more erasure error in one basis than the other. And depending which way you go, it could be either one. Okay? Okay? So these codes are nice because they have a lot of nice mathematical structure. But the other thing that's worth pointing out is that they have really good parameters. So in order to get these really good parameters, you have to go to large p. P has to be greater than n. But once you do that, these things actually saturate the singleton bound, the quantum singleton bound, right? So let me remind you what that was. That said that n minus k had to be greater than or equal to 2d minus 1. Right, so what's 2d minus 1 here? Well, it's equal to n minus k, right, when you can pick g correctly. So this is a family of codes that actually saturates a singleton bound. Remember, in the case of qubits, there weren't very many of those things. Basically, just the 513 code and distance 2 codes. But here, if you go to higher dimensions, you can saturate it further and further. And actually, you can do slightly better. By fiddling around with this, you can let n equal to p, and then there's some cases where you can even do better than that, using some other variant, not necessarily this code. So in general, as you go to higher and higher p's, you get more and more codes that will satisfy the singleton bound. And mostly that's a result of having these larger number of error syndromes to play around with. But there's also additional freedom. Okay, the same thing is true classically, actually, that as you go to higher and higher dimensions, you get more and more codes that saturate the classical singleton bound. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So then maybe I'll move on to say a little bit about the Clifford group in these higher dimensions because it's kind of interesting. So we're going to define it in basically the same way. It's a set of unitaries such that UPU dagger is again in the poly group for all P in the poly group. Okay? And as before, there's this issue about global phase, which mostly I'm going to ignore. In this case, well, there's going to be analogs of kind of the gates, the qubit gates that we're used to from the Clifford group. And there's going to be some other interesting ones, too. So in particular, so again, we're sticking to prime dimensions here. There's a Fourier transform. Okay, so this generalizes the Hadamard transform, right? Which is doing the same thing with omega equal minus 1. Fourier transform you've almost certainly seen before in, say, the context of Schwarz algebra. So what does this do if we think of it as a transformation on the polys? Well, since it's the generalization of Hadamard, it won't surprise you to learn that it takes x to z. And then what does z go to? No one's brave enough. Well, you might obviously think an analog of Hadamard could take z to x, but it can't because the commutation relations don't allow that. X and z, when you move one past another, you get a factor of omega inverse. Right? But z and x, you go the other way, you get a factor of omega. Now, in the binary case, omega is equal to omega inverse, right? Because they're both minus 1. But in this case, they're not. So what we have to do is instead map z into x inverse. Okay? And that gives us the factor of minus 1. That makes the commutation the same. Okay? So this is the extra twist, that one of the extra twists that makes the higher dimensional Clifford group interesting. Okay, here's a bigger twist. Well, so we had this pi over 4 gate in the qubit case, right, which took 0 to 0 and 1 to I times 1. But remember that factor of I has kind of gone away in this case. And so it turns out this phase gate is something substantially different. We're still going to take it to be diagonal, but it's going to do this phase instead. Jj minus 1 over 2. Omega to the jj minus 1 over 2. So it's a quadratic phase. And if you think about the qubit case, this would just be trivial, right? Because j could only be 0 or 1. 0, this is 0. 1, well, it's also 0 because you have this j minus 1 there. Okay? So this quadratic phase wouldn't mean anything at all in the qubit case. But for higher dimensions, it does mean something. And not only does it mean something, it's something important. It's the analog of this pi over 4 gate. Sorry, and that stays the same. Okay? And what I mean by that is, well, that it takes x to x times z. And z, of course, commutes with it, so it goes to z again. Okay? So what else? Well, so we had obviously, to get a generating set, we're going to need some kind of two-qubit gate. And the analog there really is the obvious analog of the qubit case. So in the qubit case, we had control naught. In this case, we'll use sum. So sum will take two states j and k into j, and then add the second one. And this, of course, is mod p. Okay? So what does that do to the polys? Well, as before, x tensor I goes to x tensor x. I tensor x stays itself. Z tensor I stays itself. But I tensor z, well, we get another one of these twists. Again, we have to preserve commutation. So we're going to get an inverse here. You get z inverse tensor z. Okay? Now, it's not at all obvious that these things generate the Clifford group. right? Well, it wasn't obvious in the qubit case. And you can try immediately to do the same thing you did in the qubit case, right? The same argument of row reduction and so on and so forth. But you'll very rapidly see that in order to do row reduction, you need one more operation. So what is that operation? The operation is scalar multiplication. And the reason you need that is, well, when you write these out as mod p matrices, well, you might have the diagonal elements not be 1, but be some other thing non-zero, right? And then you have to multiply them by some other factor in order to get them back to 1, if you want to have the identity there. Well, how do you do that? We use scalar multiplication. So what is this gate? So scalar multiplication takes j, and it gives you c times k. And of course, this is only defined for c not 0. Well, I mean, I guess you can define it for c equals 0, but it's not unitary for c equals 0. So you wouldn't be able to implement it. Okay. And so what does this do? Well, if you work it out, you'll find that it takes x to the c, and z goes to what? Any guesses? Yes?
Minus c?
No. Good guess, but wrong.
To itself?
No, also not itself. So it's the other kind of inverse, the multiplicative inverse, so z to the c inverse, z to the 1 over c. Maybe it's easier to write it, see it that way. So why is that? Well, again, x, z, when you move it past each other, you get a factor of omega inverse. And x to the c, z to some other power, you get a factor of omega inverse to the product of these two things, right? Because each x has to move past each z. Okay, so that's why it has to be 1 over c, so that the product of those two things is equal to the 1. This is one of the reasons why it's nice to work in prime dimensions, because then you're working over a field. The field numbers mod p form a field, and so everything has an inverse. Well, it's at 0, of course. Multiplicative inverse. So for instance, when we were working before mod 5, well, 1 obviously is its own inverse. 2, well, you multiply 2 by 3 and you get 1, right? 6 is 1 mod 5. So 2 and 3 are inverse to each other. And 4, well, 4 is its own inverse, because 4 is minus 1 mod 5. So 4 squared is equal to 1. And that's true for any prime. But for non-primes, of course, things that that are factor that have a common non-trivial common factor with the dimension, well, they won't necessarily have inverse. They won't have inverses of that. Okay, but I'll just think about prime cases. Okay, so this is scalar multiplication. And just offhand, you think that you'd need this. But actually, it turns out you can get it from these other things. So the proof of that is not really at all illuminating, so I'll skip it. But let's just say that by multiplying together f and r in some order, you can get this scalar multiplication out. Appropriate powers of f and r. Okay. Right. Okay. So that's all I really wanted to say about higher dimensional codes, or at least all I felt I had a burning need to say about higher dimensional codes. They'll show up as examples in the problem sets, and maybe examples in other parts of the lecture. So, but now then is a good time to ask questions about these, because then after this I'll move on to another totally different topic.
How about non-prime dimensions?
Non-prime dimensions. Well, so you can do a lot of the same stuff, but funny things happen. So first of all, there's this problem, as I said, of having, you know, things that don't have inverses. But the problem is that you can also have poly elements whose order is one of these things that doesn't have an inverse. So for instance, say if you're working, well, okay, let's say you're working dimension 6, okay, and you have the poly element x squared. Well, now its order is 3. Right, so normally the elements of the stabilizer that you're thinking of have the same order as the dimension you're working with. But here is something that's order 3, has eigenvalues not six boots of unity, but Q boots of unity. And what this does is it wreaks havoc when you start to figure out how big the actual subspace is of things that have plus one eigenvalue for it. So it becomes very hard. It's not, you can do this, but it becomes very hard to tell exactly how big a space you're working in. There's no, I don't know, I mean, I don't know that it's been really investigated in the quantum case, but it's, as far as I know, there's no general rule that'll tell you how big that subspace is. But the commutation, anti-commutation rules about detecting errors, that still applies. Yeah?
You've got two bits, and you could therefore encode them as a four, dimension four thing.
Yes.
And encode this way. Does one of these ways give you better codes in terms of preserving information?
Well, okay. So if you treat them just as qubits, then you have all the structured qubit codes. If you treat them as four-dimensional thing. Well, okay, so there's two ways to treat them as four-dimensional things. So one was the answer I gave to Martin, which you just use the same poly group mod p, and that doesn't kind of work all that well. The other way is you treat them as elements in the finite field GF4.
Right.
Okay, so this is not the same as what we were doing before, mapping stabilizer codes to GF4. This is, means that even in the standard basis, they're GF4 elements. And that, and the reason I didn't want to go into that is it requires a bunch of new machinery. But once you do that, then similar kinds of considerations can apply. And then you can use the structure of GF4 to come up with good codes. Codes that, for instance, you can come up with these polynomial codes. Polynomials can be defined over any field, finite or infinite for that matter. Although in this case, let's stick to finite. So you could define polynomial code over GF4, and that would give you, for instance, these really good codes that saturate the singleton back. Right? So that would be one reason to do that. You could get more efficient code. But the problem is that the errors kind of have double effect. Right? Because if you have these two qubits, and there's an error on one of them, that's like the whole four-dimensional thing has gone wrong. Okay? So it's a trade-off. And it's not really clear in general which is the better thing to do. So actually, this is one of the reasons why Reed-Solomon codes are used a lot classically, even without concatenation. They're used, for instance, I believe, on CDs as error correction. Because what happens is frequently when you have an error, it's not just kind of isolated errors, one here, one here, one here. It's a whole bunch of errors all next to each other. Okay? And you can see that this phenomenon I said of having, you know, breaking down a whole set of four is not so serious when you're thinking about bursts of error, connected errors like this anyway. Right, because these two bits are next to each other. And so, well, if they both go wrong, that's still only one four-dimensional thing. That's bad. So if you have long runs of these, it's not affecting nearly as many as it would if they were just kind of separate qubit or separate bits, since this is classical. Separate bits in some bigger code. Okay, so that's one reason to do that. Anyway, there's a whole lot of classical coding theory based around these ideas of five-dimensional codes for reasons like that. And for reasons I mentioned before, for concatenation. And maybe for other reasons too that I don't know, because I'm not an expert. Yeah?
So maybe this is a related question. But let's say I'm comfortable working with qubits,
mm-hmm.
comfortable working in two dimensions. Can I represent higher dimensional codes in a larger number of qubits?
Right. Well, so if you do, so if you're working with a field that's a power of two, so it's the number of qubits. Then it turns out that these GF4 codes say, so again, not the other mapping, but the new one I'm talking about. So it's polynomial GF4 code. That is a qubit stabilizer code. So in that sense, you could do it. If you take, say, that code or some code, you know, mod 5, more general code mod 5 or mod some other prime, well, then you try to expand that as qubits. Well, first of all, there's this problem of a remainder, right? There's things that you're not, states that you're not using. So mod 5, you'd need three qubits to represent that, but you're not using three of the states, right? Because they have eight possible states, you're only using five. And then what you get, while it's a stabilizer code mod 5, is not a stabilizer code for qubits. That doesn't necessarily worry you. I mean, maybe you're fine with that. But it causes kind of a mismatch in the mathematical calculations. And then when you do like these Clifford group elements, well, you have to do a bunch of qubit gates in order to actually do a single one of these. So it's possible, but has some additional baggage associated with it. Yeah.
If you have, say, n qubits where d is not necessarily the same for all of the pieces, can
right.
you come up with a reasonable code, or is this hard?
Certainly it's possible to do that. I can't offhand think of any examples. It's hard to think of examples where people have done that. There might be one or two. It's the difficulty, of course, is that in order to find good codes, usually you're taking advantage of some other additional mathematical structure. Because just, you know, trial and error is really a difficult thing to do. And it's less likely that that happens when you have things of different sizes. But it doesn't mean you can't do it. Anything else? OK. Then let's move on to the next topic. So when I say next topic, I mean something really completely different. This is the start of really the second segment of the course. So the first segment, we're thinking about error-correcting codes, where the gates were perfect, but maybe storage or communication was imperfect. So for instance, we could take some quantum data, encode it using this quantum error-correcting code, let it sit around for a while, and then decode it. And assuming our gates on either end were perfect, and we only had to worry about noise while it was waiting, then we could use these quantum error correcting codes that we've been talking about for the past month. But, of course, in real life, you can't assume that your gates are perfect. Classically, classical computers are really, really good. The gates are good enough that we don't have to worry about this. But quantum mechanically, it's unlikely to be true for a variety of reasons. One is, of course, these are just in the early stages, so you know people are struggling to get the error rates down. Another, of course, is the reasons that I talked about before. We have this wide variety of errors, including you know, continuous rotations. And so there's always going to be some noise in them. The other, of course, quantum objects are very small, inherently more subject to noise. I think I mentioned all of these reasons in the first lecture, but it maybe bears recap. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to find some way of doing computations on states that are encoded in a quantum error-correcting code. So we can take advantage of these error-correcting properties and still be able to do computations. OK, well, that's not really a very easy thing to do. When you think about it, the obvious strategy you might think, so fault tolerance. So the obvious thing you might try to do is you take your error correcting code, and then you might say, well, okay, if I want to do a gate, I'm going to decode it, and then do the gate, and then re-encode it. Okay? So this is certainly a way, if you have a quantum error correcting code, and you want to do a gate on the encoded state, to do that. But I think you can all see that this is not a very good thing to do if you're worried about errors during the gates. Right? This is not fault tolerant. So why is that? Well, there's a couple of things that could go wrong. So obviously, one problem is there could be an error there. And once you've decoded it and there's an error in that gate, well, you're out of luck. Right? You've voluntarily given up your error correction. But it's even worse than that, because there could be errors here and here also. Right? And I mean, you have no way of knowing what happens when there's an error during this decoding circuit. It might be that that will ruin the whole state. And similarly, again, with this encoding circuit. Okay? So for fault tolerance, we want to try to avoid doing this. Try to find some other way to do gates. Okay? And so in particular, one constant thing we're going to have to worry about is error propagation. So if you have, for instance, an encoded state sidebar, and it has an error on the first qubit. So now we're thinking more generally, not necessarily thinking this strategy. So we try to do something that's fault tolerant, which we don't know exactly what that means yet. But we try to do some gate. So let's say this is on xi. And we do a controlled knot between two qubits I and j. Okay? Well, then this x on the first qubit gets propagated to the, sorry, to the ith qubit, gets propagated to the jth qubit. Right? Because we know c naught will map an x to x tensor x. X tensor I gets mapped to x tensor x. So what this will be xi tensor xj times the correct state, c naught applied to the sidebar. Okay? So x propagates forward along c naught. And of course, if you look at the c naught relations, which are almost up there, same as the sum, almost, z propagates backwards. So of course, classically, I mean, again, I said we don't really need fault tolerance for classical computers. But classically, you still have this problem, right, that a bit flip error would propagate forward if you did a controlled knot. But you don't have this problem because you don't have phase errors. So in some sense, this is another sense which the quantum case is worse than the classical case. That errors will propagate both ways along unitary, two qubit unitary gates. Yeah?
I'm not sure what you call propagating forward and backward.
Oh, well, so the controlled knot is directional, right? It has a control and a target.
Yeah.
So forward, I mean from control to target, okay. And backwards from target to control. Right. But the main point is that classical gates have the possibility of only propagating errors one direction, whereas quantum gates will always propagate errors both directions. Of course, if it's a two-qubit gate, right? If it's a single-qubit gate, then it doesn't break right. Okay? And actually, that aside was really the answer, because so single qubit gates don't do anything. So really, we'd like to stick to single qubit gates. Of course, we can't do that. But we can do something similar. I guess this is what you call an erasure error. Okay, so the strategy is we're going to use something called transversal gates. So transversal gates look like this. Here we're going to have a block of the code. That's this. And here we're going to have another block of the code. And we're going to do gates only between the ith qubit of the first block and the ith qubit of the second block. So of course, if you do a single qubit operation on each qubit of a block of a quantum error correcting code, that's a transversal gate. Or if you do a controlled knot between ith qubits, from say the third to the third, second to the second, etc., That's a transversal gate. And of course, you can have transversal gates with multiple qubit gates, with 3 or 4 qubit gates. And it's just the same thing, but with more blocks. Okay, yeah?
So I assume when you build a whole circuit with that, so you have one block that goes, let's say, first, second, second. And
right.
You have a next gate, which go like first, third, second to, you
right. So you're absolutely right. Maybe I'm anticipating too much.
Is that still constant transversal? Or?
So this is actually why I said that I want the ith qubit of the block only to add and subtract with the ith qubit of the other block.
For the whole circuit.
For the whole circuit. So so I think what you're talking about is suppose I had a transversal gate that went like this. And then another one that went like this. Something like that.
Yeah.
Okay? So this one by itself might look transversal, and this one by itself might look transversal. But if you put these two together, in particular, if you use these same two blocks again and again, right, then what would happen would be an error that started here could propagate down here and then come back here. Right? And then you'd have two errors in a block, and actually two errors in both of these blocks. Okay, and that's what we want to avoid. What we'd like to say is that, so of course when we do this, the errors still propagate, right? But it propagates between blocks. And when we line them up so that the ith qubit is always next to the ith qubit, it can only ever stay in the same place. So we'll never get, if we do a series of these transversal gates, one error can only propagate to one error per block. And that's the important condition. And as you say, this is when we do it this way, where it's always the ith and the ith, then this is true even given a sequence. Of transversal gates. So your suggestion, your kind of implicit suggestion of the bad thing, that actually works as well. But if you want to do that, then you have to do error correction after each gate, right, to prevent it from getting mixed up like that. So in that case, it's OK. But when we talk about transversal gates, we usually assume this more rigorous condition.
So if you have a transversal gate, you can encode your state, basically run on parallel machines, especially something like that.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. So as it turns out, there's some code where you can do a lot of transversal gates, but unfortunately not everything, or at least not as far as we know.
It seems like that should be hard for Z gates or control Z gates.
Talk to me again at the end of the lecture. Well, Z gates and controlled Z gates are in the Pauli group and the Clifford group respectively. So the techniques we've developed so far are going to be able to say quite a lot about that, which I'll do in probably the second half. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Do you think they don't need to act like I'm in qubit, they're in qubit of the second order? We can't really just ignore that.
Sorry, say again.
It doesn't make us limited if we limited, for example, first I'm in qubit of the first act on just I'm in qubit of the second.
So going to these transversal gates, does that limit us? Well, yes, it limits us quite a lot. But in the servants of fault tolerance, we do have some choice. But as you'll see next time, probably, once we start to go beyond transversal gates, things get complicated fast. So we'd like to do as many things as we can transversally, which, like I said, is unfortunately not everything. But
so it's not universal then?
It's not universal, that's right. Yeah.
Has it been proven to be non-universal or
just universal? No. So for specific codes, you can prove that it's not universal. It seems unlikely that there's a universal set of transversal gates for any code. But it seems unlikely that there's any code that has a universal set of transversal gates. But we don't know that for sure.
So the main advantage here that instead of having four micro corrections, you're just going to be able to keep track?
Oh, you still have to do error correction.
Well,
the advantage is you don't have to do it quite as frequently.
You can just sort of keep track and do it all.
Yeah. So the point is, if you do a completely non-fault tolerant gate, when you have one error, then it becomes two errors. Okay. So if the gate itself goes wrong, for instance, and you have two errors in the same block, and if the code only corrects one error, well, you're out of luck. Okay. Whereas at least with these transversal gates, you have a time, you know, where kind of the mean time to error. So if errors are occurring one at a time, if your errors occur with probability p, it'll be time, you know, order p squared, 1 over p squared, until you get two errors in the same block. Okay? So you don't have to do error correction quite as often. Although, it turns out we will want to do that. But eventually, you'll have to do them, right? Because eventually, you do a long computation, and the errors will build up, and you'll have to make. Yeah?
When looking for a transversal set of gates that would be universal and trying to prove that it can't be done, would it be sufficient to simply say, suppose a code exists, you apply a transversal gate, if there's a slight systematic rotation and the thing's supposed to be universal?
No, sadly no. So this is maybe a subtlety that I was going to get to maybe later when talking about transversal gates. This is not actually necessary for this definition that we're doing the same thing on every qubit. Okay? And so what that means is that here's what the argument. So if you do the same thing on every qubit, then it's easy to prove that there's no code that has a universal set of gates of that form. Because you're supposed to have a universal set of gates, right? So in particular, you have some gate that's close to a small rotation. Okay, so you multiply these gates together, and it's doing a small rotation on every qubit. And remember, we said that's very close to an error has, you know, to order t squared, or sorry, t plus one. That's has order of t plus one fidelity to something that has t errors. Right, and you know our error correcting code can correct t errors, so it'll correct it back to the state that has no rotation at all. Okay, so the ability to correct errors is kind of in contradiction to the ability to do small things on every qubit. But unfortunately, the case of, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on what the answer is, the case where you do different things on every qubit means that some qubits might be doing large things while others are doing small things. So it's that's why there's no proof, as far as I know. Okay?
In principle, you might have a code, I mean, adding, say, the T going to an EDI type 4 rotation, phase rotation, to most sets, gives you a universal set. Something outside.
Sorry, what is the T gate?
Just some qubit rotation, does nothing zero, adds the EDI type 4.
So the pi for 8 rotation, yeah.
So
obviously only some 2 qubit gates to get a universal set. But,
sure.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know. But that's kind of beyond the scope of this class. It's still unknown. So let me go on to kind of talk about the techniques we're going to be using to find transversal gates and give some examples of them. But actually, I think the examples will be after the break. So let me do some terminology first. Okay, so we've kind of covered in general the reasons that we want to do these transversal gates, but I want to make things a little more precise. So to do that, I want to introduce some kind of mathematical artifacts that are going to be used to rigorously define what I mean to have a fault tolerant gate. Right. So this is going to apply more generally than just transversal gates. But you'll be able to see that the transversal gate satisfies these conditions pretty easily. Okay, so So we're going to define an ideal decoder. And the ideal decoder is a mathematical artifact. It's not a real object. That's why it's ideal. So it's a super operator that takes an encoded state corrects the errors . So this is a mathematical object, but it's not magic. So it doesn't know what the state is supposed to be. All it does is it does exactly what you would do to the state if you had perfect gates available. Okay? So it'll take it, it'll measure the synchrome. Based on the synchrome, it'll decide what the error is. It'll correct that error, and then it'll decode. Okay? So this is the reason we introduce this as a mathematical artifact. It's a way of telling us what the encoded state is, right? Even with errors on the state. Okay, I'm going to draw it this way. So this thick line is going to be an encoded block. The thin line is a decoded state. And this is the ideal decoder that takes us from one to the other. Okay? Okay, and then the other thing I want to define is an R filter. And this is a projector on the subspace, which is spanned by the code words plus states with R errors on them. Okay, so for instance, the zero filter projects just on the code space. The one filter projects on the code space, code words with one error on them, two filter, two errors, and so on. Okay? Everyone understand that? Since it's spanned by this, it doesn't really matter whether we say poly errors or non-poly errors. It comes to the same thing. Okay, so we're going to draw this by something that looks like this. And of course, it's acting on code blocks or thick lines. And we'll put a letter up here or a number to indicate what R is. Okay?
The R filter basically projects into the correctable something?
If the code corrects T errors, then the T filter projects into the correctable subspace. Right. But it's more complicated than that because obviously a state that's in the correctable subspace might be wrong. Right? So if you have so many errors that you go back to another code word, but it's the wrong code word, well then the zero filter can't tell you that. So the zero filter is just kind of a syntactic thing that tells you whether it looks like it's correctable or not. But it doesn't tell you how many errors there actually have been. But the combination of the zero filter and the ideal decoder get to tell us not whether the state is correct or not, but whether the gates are working right. And so that's why we want to define these things. So let me write down the appropriate statements. So I get the blackboard to be clean. Today I wore white so that the handle of the chalkboard would be chalked us better. Okay. So I'm just going to, for the moment, just talk about fault-tolerant gates. And then later, either at the end of today or next time, we'll talk about other kinds of fault-tolerant gates. So there's two properties that I'm going to want for gate to be fault-tolerant. So the first one says that if you have an R, so if you take a state, you put it through an R filter, then you do a gate with S errors, and then you look at the output, that the output should now have at most R plus S errors. Right? That makes sense. That means that there's R errors input, S error, S new errors. And so what you want is that the gate hasn't propagated the existing errors or the new errors badly to create extra errors. So what we're saying is that this as so come on. Is equal to this. And we're only going to demand that this be true when R plus S is less than or equal to T. Okay? So this thing over here, well, it's some projector followed by some, well, not necessarily unitary operator, because there's been errors, right? So some CP map. So overall, this is a non-trace preserving, but completely positive map. And I'm saying that the left-hand side is then equal to the right-hand side as non-trace preserving completely positive maps. Okay?
So isn't they equivalent, but they're not equal?
No, they're equal.
Okay.
They're equal. Okay? And so this is the way I've got it is for one qubit gate. So for a two qubit gate, it looks similarly. So now we have two filters. This is going to be R1 and R2. You have a gate with S errors in it. And this is supposed to be equal to R1, R2. So if you have a two-qubit gate, these errors could get propagated to the other qubit, right? So now we have filters here, which are R1 plus R2 plus S. Okay. So even if this gate is perfect, the number of errors on each of these qubits could increase, right? Because you could merge the errors from the two qubits. And again, we're only going to insist on this when R1 plus R2 plus S is less than or equal to T. So this property is saying the errors propagate reasonably. Okay? So everyone kind of understand this property?
So I don't know what you need to define specifying that R plus S is minus S less than T.
So for the case of transversal gates, clearly they satisfy this condition without putting any constraints on them.
Yeah.
Right? And that's just kind of trivial. Right? We define transversal gates to do that. But like I said, transversal gates are not universal. So we're going to want to have more complicated constructions, and maybe for those more complicated constructions, it'll work for a small number of errors, but not for a large number of errors. So for instance, there might be we might be necessary to do an error correction step during the gate. Right? And we don't expect the error correction step to work unless the total number of errors is less than T, less than equal to T. So offhand, the usual constructions actually don't require that constraint. But it's for fault tolerance, we don't really care what happens when there's too many errors. Is what it boils down to. Okay? So transversal gates automatically satisfy this. Okay. But I guess you can infer from the name, gate property 1, that there must be a gate property 2. And you can maybe infer from the fact that it finds two objects that this gate property 2 is going to involve the ideal decoder. And if you did infer that, you'd be correct. So what does it look like? Gate property 2 says, suppose we have an encoded block that passes through an OR filter, so it has at most OR errors on it. And then it experiences a gate with S errors. And then we stick it into an ideal decoder. What do we get out? Well, what we'd like to be able to say is that this gate is doing on the logical qubit the gate that's supposed to be represented, right? So in other words, what we're saying is that if we were to take this input state and decode it right away, and then do this ideal gate of the same type, then that would be the same operation. Right? That doesn't matter whether we do the ideal decoder before or after the fault-tolerant gate. And again, we'll only insist that R plus S be less than or equal to T. In this case, this is really important, right? Because there's no way of having this otherwise. Because otherwise, you could have lots of errors accumulate between these two things. And then there'd be an error. And this ideal decoder, like I said, is not magic. It doesn't know what the state is supposed to be. It just corrects any errors that it sees. So it has no more error correcting capability than the actual error correcting code that you're using. Okay. So this is important. And then, of course, there's a similar thing for two-qubit gates. You have R1 here, R2. We do ideal decoders on each of these. And that's the same as taking the input. Doing ideal decoders on both of those, and then doing the ideal two-qubit gate. And so this gate property 2 says that fault-tolerant gates do the right gate on encoded states. So we'll say a gate is fault-tolerant, the gate implementation is fault-tolerant, if it satisfies these two properties for the appropriate code. I guess, I mean, I've kind of implicitly been saying this, but T, you probably can figure out, is the number of errors. So there's some, the fault-tolerant implementation is attached to some particular quantum error corrected code, and T is the number of errors that code can correct. So the distance is at least 2T plus 1. Okay? So that's probably a good time to take a break. You'll have some time to mull this over. And then when we get back, we'll see some actual fault-tolerant gates. Yeah?
So just so far, it seems to be everything's constructed like you have each block corresponds to one encoded qubit.
Yeah. Well, so I haven't, there's nothing that I've, yeah, so implicitly that's true.
So can you extend that to...
Absolutely. Okay. And in fact, if you look at what I've written down, it doesn't really depend on having just one encoded qubit. Right? So there's only one line coming out of this ideal decoder, but you could still think of it as two qubits or five qubits or whatever. Five encoded qubits. The difference is that... So when I say two-qubit gate, I mean a gate that's interacting two blocks. Right? It could be... I mean, if you have a block that's encoding multiple qubits, it could be that even one qubit gate can do interactions among those encoded qubits. Okay. So the distinction one qubit gate, two qubit gate, maybe it could be one block gate, two block gates. And if you're doing it transversely, then it's the physical.
Because then if you have like it's 2 qubit encoded in one, then you know, you're gonna have single qubit gate, encoded qubit gate, which is gonna be sort of working on half one block. Right? Mm-hmm. So do you need properties out of it, or like how's those two gate property applied to that?
So I'm not sure what you mean. So that up here, it says nothing at all about how many encoded qubits there are, right? It doesn't even come into it. It's just, this is just purely looking at the encoded block and seeing how many errors there are for gate property one, right? So the number of encoded qubits doesn't even enter it. Gate property two, it does, but it does down here. And for instance, we'll see that for certain codes, doing a control NOT gate transversally, so doing control NOT gate on each qubit, will do the control NOT gate between all the encoded qubits. So what happens then is that this logical ideal gate is a bunch of control NOTs. Okay, but other than that, this condition, well, actually it was this one, but this condition just holds directly. Okay, it's these things are all very abstract. So it doesn't really matter whether they're kind of 1 qubit gates over here and 2 qubit gates over here. That's okay. Okay. And maybe it'll be, well, we won't see too many examples of multi-qubit gates, so I don't want to promise too much. But there's a homework problem that involves it. So maybe that's why you're asking.
I don't know.